the Practical Missions Podcast. I'm your host. Today on the pod, I have a very special guest who shares in incredible insights, vulnerability, and humility what her life of the last 33 years in missions has been like. We talk about examining your faith, seasons of darkness and doubt, the inner voice of the missionary, singleness over the decades, and a whole lot more. I've added quotes to the website, so if you click the link below in the show notes, you can find a bunch of quotes from this episode that I think will be really helpful. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy today's episode. Well, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to have you.
Yeah, hey.
On. And I want to start off. You've been in missions for a long time. You've had many different roles. You've had a lot of different experiences. Take me back to the beginning. What's the story of how you got into missions in the first place?
The beginning really was my youth leader, who, when I was 15, joined the company that I'm now part of. And I was quite fascinated because he took a whole year, which to my 15-year-old mind was like an eternity, to go all out and be in missions in Austria. But at that time, people who joined the company didn't know yet when they joined where they were going to go. And it was kind of like there was this conference and it was like a marketplace and they would walk from stall to stall and the different fields would advertise their opportunities. And then people would pray and decide at the conference where they felt God was leading them. So very different times to now. And so after he knew where he was going, he was coming back for 2 weeks and he brought this whole bunch of people who had come from overseas and who didn't have the opportunity to go back to their home churches. And so that was my first encounter with people who were just so serious about God. Like, I mean, I remember there was an American girl that was going to India. There was another American guy that was going to Sudan. And for 2 weeks, they were in my village. And I was really getting to know them. And I had their prayer cards up on my wall. And so that I think aroused my interest first. And then over the next years, I did a whole bunch of short-term outreaches all in my home country. And then some years in, I benefited. I mean, it just exploded my perspective and mind. And so then I attended a weekend at the company office in my home country. And one of the things we did there was a prayer night. And in the prayer night, they said, we are thinking of stopping the short-term outreaches because we don't have enough staff to organize them. And I was like, whoa, no way, you can't do that. I want other young people to have that opportunity. And so it was a very kind of rational process in many ways to think, well, actually, if every person who's been blessed through their short-term outreaches gives 1 year back, they will never be short-staffed again. Well, if that is what I think, why don't I do that? Well, if I want to do that, let me do that now so that I can get it out of the way and get on with my life. Well, that was 33 years ago. And so my gap year extended to be slightly longer than I anticipated.
A gap lifetime.
But it's super interesting because I think I joined with a number of preconceptions about full-time Christian work. One of them being, this is a massive sacrifice. And even the amount of arrogance that I had in my conversations with God, thinking and saying, I hope you appreciate all the sacrifices I'm making here. And I mean, I stayed in my home country, but I'm giving up my job. I'm giving up my flat. I'm giving up my salary. I'm giving up yada, 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 yada. And it didn't take God very long to make me realize, actually, I see that slightly differently. And I came to realize that the God that always had been there, all of a sudden I needed him in a lot more practical ways, but I also started to experience him in a lot more tangible ways, because I was thrown on him in a way that I hadn't been before. And so within the first 6 months or so, I think my mindset shifted considerably. And I realized, actually, I'm the one who's the privileged one here, and I'm the one who's the honored one to get to participate in what God is doing in the world. So that was the starting point.
And how did you move from there to cross-cultural work?
I think early on in my involvement in Christian work, I worked in personnel for a number of years after my initial couple of years. And I saw people going out very idealistic. And some of them came back. They had grown. They had blossomed. They had experienced God. Some of them came back and they were in pieces. And their faith had suffered, even though they had given years to full-time Christian work. And I was intrigued. And I think that started arousing my interest in how can we support people better on the field. And I started to realize I can only do that much in preparing people before they go. But if I really want to help people stick it out and grow and process all the stuff that's happening to them on the field, I need to be on the ground. I need to be where they are. That's one piece of the story. And then I found myself in quite a toxic situation, so I knew I had to leave. And so I went to Bible college, because that is a great place to park yourself when you haven't got a cooking clue what to do with your life. Nobody is going to dispute it. It's like, I'm going to study theology. Great. And so I did. I spent a couple of years in a Bible college, but very much geared towards missions. And there, again, I did some research around attrition. Why do people leave the field? Mm. And particularly, why do they leave prematurely? And I was quite intrigued with the given face-saving reasons that people gave. And then in personal interviews, the real reasons why people had left.
What were some of those differences? Do you remember?
Well, like, I mean, the given reasons are children's education, aging parents, all the rest of it, because it was very shameful for people to say, well, I just couldn't hack my coworkers. My team was a nightmare. My leader was a monster. I hated the people that I was supposed to serve. So there were quite some big discrepancies, but a lot of it came down to miscommunication, conflicts, disappointments, but people didn't feel it was safe to say so. And so everyone would understand. It's like, yeah, well, my kid needs to get proper schooling, and so it's my responsibility to return home, yada yada.
So you were at this Bible school, you were seeing these people coming back, and you were wondering, how can we prevent the attrition rate that we're seeing of workers coming off the field prematurely? Then what happened?
Then what happened was I'd been exposed to North Africa even before going to Bible college. And I actually traveled with one of those presentation teams that shared the needs in the Muslim world. And I was translating the same stories night after night after night. And I was in tears night after night after night, even though I had heard the stories many times before. And I was like, this is just not right that I have 3 or 4 different translations of scripture on my bookshelf, and I'm not quite sure which one am I feeling today. And then there are people who have become believers who have for 10 years not been able to put their hands on scriptures, or have never ever tasted fellowship, because they've come maybe to faith through media, but no one, like, there is just such a small group of believers in the country, and the whole injustice of people not having been given the opportunity to actually respond. So I had a passion for that, but also I knew I'm not a church planter, I'm not an evangelist. And so it was the kind of like, how do I contribute to people who have this calling staying, and in that way enable the Mohammeds and the Fatimas to hear while being true to what God had put into my gift pack.
And again,
going back a little bit in my history, early on in my career with the company, if you want to call it that, I had been part of a church planting team in former Eastern Europe. And it was the year that my church, still 33 years later, refers to the year that I failed.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Great way of labeling it.
Yeah, wonderful.
Wonderful, yeah. And I really failed because I was thrown into leadership of a church planting team. But I didn't have a clue about leadership. I didn't have a clue about church planting. I didn't have a lot of support, investment, and development. And I had a good portion of insecurity as a person that kept me from shouting help like I would do now. So it was a very lonely year and a very hard year. And I became quite a controlling leader, as many insecure leaders become. And so I think, again, looking back over my life, that is where God also ignited a passion for people development and leadership development, because I thought, I don't want people to have to go through this, to be thrown in at the deep end, but don't have a safe space and a support and don't be equipped for what they're doing. So that all got me into people development, training, leadership development, but then really with a heart and passion to apply those things in a context where there is very few workers, very, very few results, and where you need long-term workers to really see something and where attrition is high. Those are the different puzzle pieces putting together.
Wow. So you went, so when you went out to North Africa, you went out for 6 years. And what were your roles while you were there? I like this. You said you're going to a very unreached, hard place. And you know you're not a church planter and you know you're not an evangelist. So what did you go out with the intention of doing, or what were your roles?
My role really was people care, which was something that didn't exist in that place at the time. And the job didn't exist. I created the job. So I had gone for some short-term trips, and I had basically interviewed workers in the field and said, if there was someone here for you, to kind of almost like a pastor to the workers, what are your needs? What are your concerns? What is the missing thing that would help you feel supported, cared for, looked after, that would enable you to stay? And so they gave me loads and loads of ideas. From that, I compiled a job description and basically approached the leader in one of the North African countries and said, look, this is what your people say. This is what I have been doing. This is what it could look like. What do you think?
Wow.
And he took me, and it's actually quite funny, because 2 years after I had been there and he started seeing the impact, he was like, you know, when you first came and you presented all of this, I was like, I have no idea what she even talks, is even talking about. But she seems enthusiastic enough, and I'm sure she can't do too much harm, so why don't we have her? And so we had, I think, about 55 people from our own company in the context at the time in up to 9 locations. And so I literally just made sure that I visited each one of them several times a year. And they knew they have a morning or an afternoon or an evening at their disposal to bring whatever they want to bring. And I brought in some folk from the Bible college that I had been studying at to do seminars. I organized different input things. I started resourcing people on the field with good material. But I think that the most important thing was just giving people a space to say what is going on versus what is supposed to be there. And I really saw how that made a difference.
Somebody told me once that most cross-cultural workers don't feel seen. And I think it sounds like you provided a place where people were really seen.
And even helping people, I mean, helping people normalize and validate what they were experiencing. I remember distinctly a lady in her, I think she was in her early 30s. She had run $1 million programs for a company in North America, and now here she was reduced to the state of a two-year-old because she couldn't even pay her electricity bill on her own. And just the dips of confidence that she went through and everything that had made up her identity being stripped away and just spending hours with her. Listening, but also validating that experience. And I remember saying to her, you know, for the first 6 months, survival is an achievement. Because I think, I mean, you know it from yourself. You're asking yourself, what am I achieving? And while you're learning language and while you're feeling like a complete idiot, you're really not achieving very much. And so helping people and walking with people through that very, very challenging season. And I mean, that person is still in North Africa some 20-something years later. Wow. And she will attest to it, to the, well, actually, it was that support that empowered me to stay and the chance to just kind of process stuff and be given perspective. So it was very, very life-giving and very powerful, actually.
I've seen this as well on the field where people who are successful in their careers back in their home countries struggle a lot in the beginning when they come out, and it's like, I can't even say I'm hungry. You know, I can't do anything on my own.
Exactly, yeah.
And then we also have the other side. We also have the other side where we have people who, like myself, you know, have been out on the field for 150 years or something like that. And it can be very easy to tie my identity to my being a missionary. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on how to decouple your identity from, like, I'm a missionary in the Arab world, like these kind of negative ways or unhelpful ways of identifying ourselves?
I mean, it's a very interesting thing because I think nowadays it's changing a little bit, I think, with the younger generation, but with the older generation, there was certainly a very prestigious thing about being a missionary in a hard place. And so again, helping people acknowledge that, because it's not supposed to be there. Like, your identity is not supposed to be in your work and the brownie points that you hope to gain by serving in a hard place, and the prestige and admiration that people give you for being in a hard place and suffering and sacrificing, and surely the assumption how much that will make you holier and therefore more pleasing to God or more important and special in the eyes of the church and your supporters. And I think uncoupling your identity from that is only possible if you ruthlessly actually look at what are my real motivations here and what is really going on and what all is coming under threat if you strip that away. And I mean, I remember distinctly, I've had the beautiful privilege of moving some people on who were stuck with that very thing. Like, I remember distinctly a gentleman, with whom I had been able to build the trust that made it possible for him to say, I hate being here. I don't love the people. They get on my nerves. I don't want to be here. And when I asked him, so what keeps you here? He's like, you know, my parents were missionaries. They worked in a hard place, and something within me wants to impress them, wants their approval, and that is a big part of why I'm here. And it was actually quite interesting because then his parents came and visited, and he was devastated because they commented and said, you know, this is actually quite comfortable in comparison to what we were going through.
Wow, interesting.
And it was just really interesting because it brought him to the place of realizing, I'm a grown man and I'm still trying to gain my parents' approval and admiration and respect. And that is a big part of why I'm here. And when I asked him, like, you know, if you could not disappoint God, and if God gave you all the freedom and said, son, what do you want to do with your life? What would you do? And his face was lighting up, and he said, you know, I'd be a musician somewhere else. And that's what he did. And it was beautiful to release him. So I think creating the safe space for people, but also, again, not being overly disturbed by not having entirely pure motives, because I don't think any of us has entirely pure motives for serving God, and we fool ourselves if we don't have the courage to say, you know, this is my mixed motivations, God, and I trust you can still use me with them. Like I interviewed when I worked in personnel, I interviewed a guy that wanted to join the ships, and he was giving me so many holy reasons. And at some point I was just getting fed up, and I looked at him and I said, you know, I don't think we can take you. And he was like, why not? I said, you know, because you're too holy. We don't have people like that. We can't have people like that. Like, most of the people on board, they also want to be on board because they want to see the world and they hope to meet a nice girl. But for you, it's all holy reasons, and I don't think you'll be able to survive there. I mean, I was teasing him and provoking him, and then I got some real motives.
Oh, yeah, there's also the adventure part, right?
And I mean, again, I think God is picking humans because he wants humans. If he wanted angels, he would send angels.
I'm really glad you said that. When you were talking about motives and having the wrong motives, the first thing that came into my mind was, oh, wow, like, my motives are not 100. It's not a pure bag of motives. It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's very comforting to hear. It's very kind to hear.
And it's super interesting because as I work with workers, there's always this ideal that people aspire towards, that they think this would make me a good missionary. If only I was more holy, if only I had less personal desires, if only. And I'm thinking, no, man, God picked you. He's quite happy to work with you. Yes, growing you and changing you slowly. But that standard that we place on ourselves, which then leads to huge amounts of disappointment with yourself when you don't live up to your own ideals. Whereas God, I think, very often is like, chill. I knew that. It's okay with me.
Wow.
I can work with the material that you provide. That's hugely liberating.
Yeah, amen. And it has the effect of just taking that spotlight off of me and putting it back onto God as well. It's actually not all about me. It's all about God and what he can do with broken people like me. You've met a lot of people, and that's one of the reasons I was excited to have this conversation with you today, because your perspective is a lot bigger than mine is. I'm in a kind of a fish bubble out here, you know, in the Middle East. My window of observation is very, very tiny, but yours is actually, because of the work you do in missions, your perspective is actually very wide. You get a broad view of many different people doing many different things. Across a large spectrum. And I'm just wondering, like, when you talk to people, what are some of the, when you talk to missionaries, workers, what are some of the reoccurring issues that you're hearing? What are the reoccurring needs, fears, disappointments that you hear from missions? What is the inner voice of the missionary that you hear?
That's a really powerful question, actually. I think reoccurring themes is definitely, I'm not good enough. So being down on themselves. I think a reoccurring theme that I see is that people place on themselves the expectation that poverty and sacrifice goes with being a missionary. And it was actually quite interesting. I remember someone from another company asking me, like, why do your people wear poverty and sacrifice as a badge of honor? That also means that people don't live like they really want to live. And that's another reason why people leave missions, because it's kind of like, if I go home, I can finally live like I really want to live. So a lot of conversations evolve around what does it actually mean to live abandoned life, not just for the people that you're seeking to reach for Christ, but for yourself. What's your image of God? What's the voice of God and the tone of voice when God speaks to you? I think another reoccurring theme is I should be really excited about the Bible, but I find it really hard to read it. And just, I think a lot of the inner voice of a lot of missionaries, I think, are the discrepancies between what they feel they should be interested and passionate about and spend their life doing, and their inner desires, and helping people reconcile that. Or the discrepancy between the theology that they know, I know God cares for me, I know God loves me, says the head, and then the heart has some contradictory questions or convictions, but they seemingly are not allowed. So there's a lot of suppressing those. And I think busyness in ministry is a great way of doing that, because heaven help me that I don't let those voices rise. And so there's also a reoccurring theme is, I'm so busy, I'm so busy, I'm so busy. I'm slaving away for God. And almost the implied expectation of, and therefore God will be pleased with me and maybe I get that depth of relationship with God that would really come from learning to be with him rather than do for him. So loads and loads and loads of full-time Christian workers actually really struggle being with God and are far more comfortable doing for God, which they again feel guilty about, because they feel guilty about it because they are supposed to be loving this person that they invite. And I mean, I often provocatively ask people like, so if you really look at honestly how your own relationship with Jesus, is it the kind of relationship that you would want for people that you're inviting into that relationship?
Wow.
And if not, what changes can you make?
I've heard it said that Christian workers are often able to share the gospel more or better than they're able to experience the gospel.
Yeah, and I would say that is definitely true, which for me then begs the question, how solid is the gospel that you share if it isn't alive for you yourself? And I mean, certainly for me, that has been, there has been a season in my life where I was like, God, I'm fed up selling something that I don't have myself. And very honestly saying, you know, the discrepancy between my head and my heart has just grown too big, and I can't do this thing anymore. I think it was about 7 years or so after I joined the company and was like, I think I'm done.
Wow.
And I attended a personal development course that the company offered. It was known at the leadership school at the time, now face-to-face, but it really was an examination of what does my heart know and what has life taught me, and how can I reconcile it with my head knowledge? And that really helped me process a lot of stuff that was in my heart and has made my faith a lot more real for myself.
Can we drill down on that topic a little bit?
Sure.
When you were experiencing those seasons of darkness or doubt or whatever it was, what was the story that was going on in your head and in your heart?
I think, I mean, I've throughout my life, actually, and throughout my missions career, seasons of darkness and seasons of doubt have often been there. And I think initially, the story that was going on was like, this is not supposed to be here. This is not supposed to be here. This is not supposed to be like that. And then as the years went by, the story changed to, I really want to include you in this conversation, God. I need to include you in this conversation, God. And I found great solace in the Psalms, and particularly those that talk pretty bluntly with God. And the story also changed to becoming a little more demanding on God and saying, you know, I refuse, categorically refuse to go out and tell people about a God that isn't true for me. So until you change something in my heart, I'm kind of, this whole evangelism thing is on hold. So a little bit more stubborn, a little bit more real and authentic with God, because I think authenticity is probably one of my greatest values, and authenticity of my Christian life. I can't do fake. And so ruthlessly sitting down, drilling down into the, okay, what are these doubts? What are these accusations in my heart? And having it out with God time and time and time again. And I would say that has brought me to a healthy place with God and healthy place with myself.
Wow.
I don't know whether that actually answers your question. If not, feel free to ask.
Somebody said an unexamined life is not worth living. And it sounds like an unexamined faith as well isn't worth having. The opposite of examining these doubts, these feelings, is maybe just pushing it off to the side. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to go there. What's the danger of not examining? What's the danger of not processing these fears, doubts, questions, concerns?
Someone also said, everything that isn't processed is buried alive.
Boom.
And so I'm fully aware that stuff that isn't processed is alive within my system somewhere. And it starts to develop a life of its own. And so it's quite interesting. I've had my share of counseling and therapy and all the rest of it. I'm a great believer in helping conversations, because I don't think we're created to walk life alone and do life alone. And a big lesson that I've learned from that is the more I reject something within me and go, this is not supposed to be there, I don't want this, the more powerful it becomes.
Interesting. Tell me more about that.
Like, if I say I don't want to feel depressed, the more I reject, don't want to feel depressed, don't want to feel depressed, the more likely I'm going to dive into depression more. The more I go, I don't want to doubt God, I don't want to doubt God, I don't want to doubt God, the more powerful the questions will become. And the more I try to silence some inner voices that I don't want to hear, the louder they will become to demand attention. And I think the danger is that, like a volcano, it will erupt at the most unopportune time when something triggers stuff. And you see trigger situations. You see when people haven't processed stuff, and then something triggers it. It's like a landmine and something explodes and you go like, whoa, that reaction is completely out of proportion to the actual situation. And I think the same is true with unprocessed doubts and questions. They develop a life of their own. And when pressure comes and when difficult situations come, those questions will raise their ugly heads if they are not looked at.
And so what are the steps to processing then?
I think step one is probably noticing without judging. Like, what we almost immediately do is we notice something and we decide this is right, this is wrong, this should be or this shouldn't be, versus saying, oh, I'm noticing my connection with God seems pretty flat at the moment. How interesting. I wonder what that's about. So noticing and then exploring with curiosity rather than denying and suppressing or immediately judging. Oh my God, I don't connect with Jesus. I took it like, oh, how interesting. Well, the last week, reading the Bible was about as life-giving as reading the phone book. How interesting. Wonder what's going on there. And then I think allowing what is there to surface and name it and articulate it and acknowledge it and let it be and be very relaxed about it. Because like one of the things that always fascinates me is how disturbed I get about myself. And then I'm like, huh, God, you really aren't by far as disturbed by this as I am. You knew already what I'm discovering about myself. And then to go, okay, God, help me. What do I do with this? And like particularly questions, accusations, and disappointments. They need to be talked out with God, expressed, rather than buried. And there's a lot of disappointments on the field. There's a lot of expectations, a lot of assumptions of how our life is supposed to work out. And then stuff happens that wasn't what we signed up for, or at least what we thought we signed up for. And it's like food that needs to be digested. And some of it needs to be vomited out. And so I'm a great believer in, yeah, just in real honesty with God and processing, grieving disappointments and taking the time and go like, man, that was a dream that I had. Hasn't happened. It hurts like hell. Rather than covering the spiritual blanket of those who serve the Lord and love the Lord all the best. Like it always is. Like we have all these Bible verses and often we put them like a cover on top of stuff that then doesn't get processed, but it remains moldy underneath. You're looking very thoughtful.
Well, I think those are powerful words, because I think probably Christian ministry in general, maybe missions specifically, is a series of unmet expectations, is a series of it's just a long string of unanswered prayers. It's a long string of unfulfilled dreams and unmet expectations. That's what most of it is in missions. Mm-hmm. That's been my experience, and that's been the experience of a lot of people I've met. Unless you are, you know, this kind of 5% of missionaries that actually see stuff happening, you know, if you're the 95%, that's just like, wow, we're just working hard here and nothing's happening, or things are going backwards, not forwards, according to the way we perceive things. So just hearing, I think hearing what you are saying is very, is a word timely spoken. Thanks for saying it. I think there's a kindness there that says, what am I feeling? And oh, isn't that interesting? I wonder what's going on there. Rather than saying, I can't believe I'm thinking this thought again. You know, oh, I can't believe, haven't I dealt with this already? You know, this kind of like our natural tendency to be harsh.
Yeah. Which again, disables us to be gracious to other people if we can't be gracious to ourselves. And to me, that is the core of the gospel. Like it's an invitation into grace, kindness, and compassion. That's the heart of the gospel. And unless I apply the gospel to myself, I have very little to give. I guess that's why I feel so passionate about it. Because I'm like, this Jesus that I'm telling other people about, that is kind, that is non-judgmental, I need to allow this Jesus to be the same Jesus to me. And if I don't, I will almost not be able to allow people to fully taste Jesus if I haven't tasted Jesus myself.
Yeah, I find myself getting frustrated when I don't see the growth in other people and people I'm discipling, when I don't see them growing at the speed and velocity that I want them to. It can be this kind of, what's wrong with you? Why haven't you grown more in this area? when really that attitude is probably a reflection of something going on in my own heart and how I'm feeling about myself.
It may just be.
We don't need to go into that. We can leave that for a private counseling session or something.
Sure, not counseling, but coaching happily.
That's right. One of the things that you said to me before we pushed the record button was that you are caught up on a lot of the stuff you want to be caught up on. And there is this freedom there. Yay! There is a freedom in your schedule that you seem to be really enjoying. And I want to talk about the idea of rest. Rest for workers. And here's what I see. I see kind of like the workaholics on one side, which is like, you already mentioned it, you know, I need to be doing to kind of prove my worth. Missionaries never rest. We have to live this life of like the cross on both shoulders. And if you don't have one, go look for one to put on your shoulder. And there's almost like the bragging rights of, I'm so tired because I'm doing so much. And then there's also the other side, I think, of people on the field who actually have too little to do and they're a bit bored. And being bored is also very unrestful. It is not a restful state to be in. It's almost as exhausting as working too hard. What is a good way for Christian cross-cultural workers to rest? What are some things that you've learned along the way, or do you have any best practices for your own life?
I think a lot of people don't rest because they don't have a cooking clue what to do when they're not working.
Wow.
Like when I ask people, what do you do for fun? Sometimes I get very blank looks. And they go like, I have got no idea. I really don't know what I do for fun. I don't do things for fun. And so for me, fun and play and rest and celebration are core to living a good Christian life and core to ministry. And when I ask, I don't know whether you've ever seen this thing, this like life dimension wheel where you have the different segments of like finance, spiritual life, personal development, family, ministry, and you ask people to fill in their level of satisfaction with each of the areas. And consistently I see that people like, oh, I'm so fulfilled with my ministry, but actually hobbies and recreation, it's like there is next to nothing. And so I think there is a philosophical thing that's part of it, of like, I have to be productive to be worthy. So there needs to be a mindset shift in order to permit rest. But then there also needs to be a discovery process of what's actually restful and life-giving to me. And if I don't know that, then I work by default because I want to avoid boredom. So if I have a whole day ahead of me that is free, but I don't know what to do with it and how to enjoy it, then I'm going to try and avoid it. So I think identifying and going like, huh, where do I actually feel alive? When I think, like for myself, I love dancing. I love live music. I love board games. I love wasting time with people. I love having guests. And so when I have some free time coming, and that isn't always true, I also know the days where I'm like, I wish it was Monday again so that I was allowed to work again. Because I try to be very disciplined about Sabbath on a Sunday, just really learning to take a day off. But I can totally see how the drive to work can be when I don't know what to do with myself just now. So learning to identify what actually gives me joy, what gives me life, I think is pretty key. And embracing playfulness as a spiritual discipline, just like we do prayer. Because I think God must have had enormous amount of fun playing with things. But like, do we think of God as a productive God or a playful God?
I was on a website that has free images. So you can upload your images and then people can download it copyright free. So I was looking for an image to pull off the website, and I wanted a picture of a happy man, right? That was what I wanted.
Okay.
So I typed into the search bar on this website, I typed in happy man, and every single image was of groups of guys. So two or more guys together. I thought it was interesting that according to this algorithm, there is a kind of like happiness is also connected to being in community with other people.
Yeah.
When we think of the idea of fun, you know, I laugh more when I'm watching a movie with somebody.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Than when I'm watching the same movie by myself.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So no. I think especially for single people, and maybe we can move into that.
Sure.
For single people, finding people who are like-minded in at least one area and doing something with them. So maybe I have my like-minded dancing friend
that
I'm dancing with, or whatever. Maybe board game friend that I play board games with. Maybe if we could just talk about singleness for a while. But I wonder, what are the costs of singleness and what are the benefits of singleness for somebody in missions, and maybe for you in particular, what have been the costs? What have been the benefits?
The benefits have been tremendous opportunities, lots of freedom to try things, the opportunities to explore things, also the opportunities to pursue friendships and live friendships in the way that married people, I think, often don't, interestingly enough, because the family is so often the unit where they look for everything, and that isn't always as satisfying as they think it should be or could be. Benefits, I think, have been lots of time that I can fill how I desire without restrictions and limitations, and I'm a very freedom-loving person. So having tons of freedom to make decisions, whether it's my finances, whether it's where I want to do holidays, whether it's personal development that I want to pursue. Like, I don't have to negotiate with anyone, particularly the last few years that I've lived on my own. Like, before, I've lived mostly in shared situations. Costs, I think sometimes feeling on my own with practical challenges. I'd really love a handyman in my house sometimes. Particularly now that I own a house, it's like, okay, I'm not sure I want a husband, but a guy who can fix things would be very nice sometimes. I think as I grow older, the cost has been the lack of one person with whom there is that sense of continuity. And the cost, I think, and I'm not sure that it's, I think it's both cost and benefit, actually. Is that you don't have a default person at home to do things with. Like, you always have to initiate. You always have to contact people. And sometimes I just find that really tiring. But that, again, works on the assumption that the partner at home wants to do the same things that you want to do. And from my observation, that certainly isn't always the case when I see my friends' lives. And even it's interesting because we often talk about loneliness as singles. And I certainly have experienced loneliness. I don't think any person on the planet has not experienced loneliness. And maybe more so in our individualized cultures than in communal cultures, where people naturally, there's always people around. And so I've noticed that I struggle less with loneliness when I'm somewhere, say, in Africa or in Latin America, where there's always people and something going on. But I also think it's a often wrong assumption that it's the singles that are lonely and it's the marrieds that are not. I think loneliness is certainly a challenge for me as a single, but I think it is a human challenge. And again, when I did some research, I read some research actually, it was quite interesting to see that the loneliest people on the field were not the singles.
Interesting.
But They were the wives, particularly of tent makers.
Wow, very interesting.
And it's interesting because I think for us as singles, it's almost acceptable,
To be lonely.
even if sometimes shameful, because of course Jesus is supposed to be my husband and all the rest of that. And I have lots of opinions on that one. Like when people say, Jesus is my husband, I'm like, okay, and how is your sex life? Like, really? Jesus is your husband? Okay.
It's
Tell
long
me more.
distance.
Yeah, I guess so. So, I mean, we spiritualize stuff. And as you might have gathered from this podcast so far, I'm not into spiritualizing things. I'm like, Jesus is the bread of life, but I still want to have breakfast. So there's certainly, I mean, I'm in my 50s now, so probably not having a sex life is a bit lower on the scale than it maybe was earlier on in my life. That certainly is part of the challenge of being single. And then the kind of, yeah, well, yeah, there's lots of things that I could say about that.
Do you find that there is a difference, or how have you found the difference between being single in your 20s, 30s, 40s, and now into your 50s? Is there, do you see a scale or noticeable differences in how you address your own singleness?
Well, okay, so in my 20s, of course, every conference, while you're pretending to listen to the speaker, you're looking around and
Potential.
going like, he looks cute. Yeah, you look around and you kind of go like, oh, maybe I'll have coffee with him or or oh darn, he looks like he's got someone. Dang. So that's more the 20s. 30s is probably more wrestling through, like 20s for me certainly. I assumed I'll be married because that's what people do. 30s is more the wrestling through what if not.
Wow.
And I think for me the 30s were very much a decade of making the very conscious decision, I don't want to spend my life in the waiting room, because I've seen too many people, particularly women, maybe I've heard it more from women. I don't know whether men are like that. But a lot of women seem to put their life on hold until Mr. Right, or Mr. Turns Out Not So Right in the end, shows up. And then life begins. And so there was a very conscious, I don't want to put my life on hold and assume that life really only begins if I'm married. So I had to wrestle. And again, I mentioned this leadership course that I did that shifted a lot of things. And one of the things that it shifted was my shame about being single and my assumption that there was something distinctly not right about being single that leaves me incomplete. And actually, I think in my 20s and 30s, I had a number of relationships with guys, even though deep in my heart I knew this is not the person I really want to be with, but I rather am with someone than on my own. And God gave me a very interesting picture. And the picture was of a supermarket where, you know, when you go, the supermarket closes at 6:30 or so, and you jump in at 6 p.m. and you know you've got dinner guests and you want to make salad, and there's really just this one little salad left and it's slightly yellow and brown already, but at least it's a salad, so you buy it. You would never buy it if there was choice. But if there's no choice, and it was that was the image I had of myself. It's like I have to be glad if someone picks me so that I don't stay on the shelf. And just the shame that was attached with being on the shelf. And God really challenged me about that and said, you know, your being single is not a value statement about you. It doesn't diminish who you are. And I think something got healed in me at that time. And so being able to leave that shame behind then enabled me to start thinking, okay, how do I want to live if I don't have a partner? And sitting down and literally also thinking through, okay, what are my needs? How might they be met in a marriage? But how can I intentionally make sure that they are met as a single? So, community, stimulating conversation, continuity in friendships, vulnerability, support. Like to really sit down and think, okay, what do people associate with being married? And if I'm not married, how can I take care of myself in a healthy way? Particularly realizing that if I don't do that, I make myself very vulnerable to stupidity. And I remember I traveled a lot for my work, and I remember for a season, there was this little pattern that I would come back from a trip, I'd be tired, I'd be vulnerable, and inevitably I would be seated next to some nice businessman on the plane that clearly expressed an interest in extending the time together beyond the flight. And it was a kind of like, okay, this is interesting when I'm needy and when I'm tired. I could easily be prone to do something very stupid. And so I put accountability for myself in place, but also looked at, okay, how do I ensure that I don't get to this needy place where I'm so hungry that I'm no longer selective in what I'm eating?
Wow.
Does that make sense?
It does, of course, yeah.
I sat down with many, I mean, Mission Field is full of singles,
Yeah.
men and women. And so I've often used an image with a lot of the people that I sat down with where I said, you know, when you're starving, you no longer adhere to the standards that you would normally have for healthy eating and all the rest of it. You just open the fridge and you stuff into your mouth whatever is there.
Yeah.
And the same is true relationally, that if I'm starving, I'm just going for anything and everything that promises to meet my hunger, whether that's porn, whether that's illicit affairs, whether anything that kind of promises to feed that need. And so, how do you keep your fridge stocked? And how do you make sure that you don't even get to the place where you're so starving that everything that you normally stand for goes out of the window?
Wow, I think that is very insightful and very helpful. And yeah, and I think the lie, part of the lie is that, well, I'm so hungry, I'll eat this now. And the lie is that, and I'm not going to regret it later, or that this is going to be better in the long term, than not having it. So I might as well take it, when that's just simply probably not the truth. Hey, maybe we should leave it there for now. I have thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with you. I'm very grateful for your insight, and I really mean that. I think you have tremendous insight into situations and into the human heart and mind. And so I think this has been such a valuable conversation. Thank you for being part of it. Thank you for being willing to share your years of experience, and your kind vulnerability, as well.
Privilege and honor, and fun too. And it got me thinking through a lot of stuff myself. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Amen to that. No, thank you. It's the privilege is ours. It's our opportunity to be able to listen and learn from you. I felt like today's episode had a lot of content that should be shared and should be heard. So if you know somebody who you think would benefit from today's episode, share it with them. And in the meantime, remember, it's okay to be normal.